fossil fuels into a liability-inducing event would be more energy is produced overseas to meet demand, because let's face it, we still rely heavily on fossil fuels in this country to meet our basic energy needs, and America isn't just going to turn on a dime and go back to the Stone Age. This means that energy becomes more expensive and is increasingly produced by less efficient coal-burning plants in other countries like China, with fewer environmental regulations and a greater release of greenhouse gases worldwide. So the result is that climate change would actually get far worse if you allowed this litigation, which, at least to me, seems ridiculous. All of this is to say that fundamentally changing public nuisance law isn't the answer. It's a distraction, and worse than that, it can be a counterproductive proposed solution, which raises the question, what is the solution on critical issues such as climate change, gun violence, opioid abuse? And that's where many of the people in this room come into play. Again, these public nuisance lawsuits are often a direct response to frustration with the lack of action by the federal government, most notably Congress. So the onus is really on Congress to act to regulate carbon emissions and enact better gun laws. And I know it's a really hard, for me to say that, it's really hard as a practical matter to move the needle on these issues. It's a big lift. But just because something is hard isn't a good excuse or a reason to just try to punt everything to the judiciary, which frankly is not equipped to deal with these national policy setting issues. And happy to discuss this in more detail.
All right, thanks, Chris. Rich, did you want to take a second, maybe comment on something that Chris had talked about?
Sure. I guess it won't be a surprise. I don't agree with everything that Chris said. Let me just make a few points. Chris talked about causation, that you have to show that the conduct or the product is causing the problem, and wrongdoing, something unreasonable about that conduct, something negligent, some basis for the fault. Those are our pillars of our legal system. Nobody can be held accountable for damages unless the plaintiff can show the damage, the causation, and the wrongdoing. That's true in product liability, and it's true in public nuisance. So there's no free pass here. The legal system has requirements for causation, for a showing of wrongdoing, and so does public nuisance. And when we talk about climate change, it is not the mere production of fossil fuels. If one reads the complaints, and based on the investigative journalism that was done a few years ago, we now know, also from Exxon's archives, that they predicted these impacts of climate change 50 years ago internally. They're scientists. But that is not the information the company acted on. That information was buried, and worse, they funded a disinformation campaign that was bad science once the academics started to publish this type of information. So it is not the mere selling of a legal product. It is the deceitful promotion and marketing of that product, the cover-up of the science, and a campaign to make sure that the science does not become publicly known. So these are the requirements that one has to meet to prevail in these cases. And we really are really mixing apples and oranges here. Courts are in place to deal with damage. When victims are damaged, our legal system gives them a day in court. If you don't have damage, you're not going to court on nuisance or any other theory of liability. You must be damaged. You must show who hurt you and how in order to recover. That is a role of courts. This Congress does not want to be in the business of deciding how much money victims of pollution should receive. They've never said they want to be in that business. They're not in that business, and that's not what they do. That's what courts are for. Alternatively, the legislature is to determine environmental policy. That's not what courts are for. That if Congress wants to develop a plan to deal with climate change on a regulatory basis and regulate emissions, we hope they do it, and we hope they do it soon. And I think the bottom line here is not, is it the courts or is it the legislature? From a public health point of view, from the point of view of children getting sick, of the climate ecosystem being destroyed, how do these systems work together to protect the public health? That is the relevant question, not either or. Thank you.
Absolutely, please.
Just for a minute. So I thought the apples and oranges analogy was a good one, because as Rich mentioned, we're talking about, in the case of climate change litigation, the allegations include deceptive information in the marketing and sale of a product. We have an entire deceptive trade practices and consumer protection law exist to address the alleged unlawful marketing of a product. That's an entire well-developed regime, area of law. It has nothing to do with public nuisance law. Public nuisance law is an unreasonable interference with someone's use of land, for the most part, or like noxious chemicals and things like that. We have other areas of law that have been designed to address explicitly that type of a complaint. And the idea that these aren't politically motivated, or that they're not trying to seek through the imposition of massive tort liability, regulatory changes, I think it's just frankly false, but you don't have to take my word for it. The very people who bring the litigation have expressly said that. To quote Maine's Attorney General, it's a shame that we're here. Here we're trying to sue companies because the federal government is being inactive. Now, that's someone bringing a public nuisance case. So I don't know what more of an admission you can get that, hey, yeah, we're using the fact that people have suffered an injury, but we're really trying to advance a political agenda here. So I think that's what's really going on, and I don't know how anyone can suggest that's not true.
Excellent. One question I had that might be a little helpful for the group, and maybe Rich, if you could help with this one. Can you explain the difference between a class action tort, maybe in the lead paint or asbestos context, and distinguish how public nuisance is different than a class action in those regards?
Sure. A class action is a rule of federal civil procedure that allows a group of people that have a very similar problem. They all bought a defective radio. They all bought stock in company X, and there was some fraud involved in disclosures from that company. So it's people that have the same or similar problem. And the federal rules have allowed that, created a rule, Rule 23, with a set of criteria by which they can come together and act as a group. Because they have, their problem is similar enough. The part of the judicial thinking is it would be inefficient for 100,000 people to bring the same claim over the same defective transistor radio. Let's just do it once, and if we figure it out, we'll apply that to the group, win or lose. That's what a class action is, and that we're talking about the rights of individuals in general, not the rights of governmental entities, although sometimes they can choose to organize themselves as a class. Some of the public nuisance cases that we're talking about that are brought not by a group of individuals but by a public entity, such as a state attorney general, I guess you're asking what is the difference between those two things.
Right.
The first difference is that the state is seeking its own damages. If the state has to spend money on seawalls or cleaning up the lead paint and housing, that's their money. That's their treasury that those dollars are being used for. And if they believe that there is a party who's responsible for that harm, who should be held accountable from that harm, they want to seek those damages from that party. The rights of attorney generals to recover their own damages are pretty straightforward. There's another doctrine called parens patriae, which would allow an attorney general in some circumstances to stand in the shoes of the people of the state and the individuals of the state who have a problem. That has not been used in precisely the same way that, say, an individual homeowner with contaminated land. It hasn't been used for that purpose. But in the New Hampshire MTBE case, the state attorney general sought money to clean up private drinking water wells to protect the water supply of its citizens. So there is some overlap depending on the facts of the case.
Thank you. And one thing I wanted to touch on, because I think you both mentioned it a little bit in some regard, is that some critics of public nuisance law, particularly in heavily regulated areas, have said that public nuisance suits are circumventing the legislative process. And I was wondering if both of you could maybe expand on that a little bit and kind of develop kind of, I think maybe Chris, we can start with you on how is that, like, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned in my remarks, not all public nuisance lawsuits certainly, but a lot of the modern ones today, that especially the ones that are trying to impose liability on an industry-wide level, are attempts to make an end run around a legislative process and get the courts to do what the politically accountable branches of government wouldn't do. Climate change is a great is probably the best example of that in my personal view, because the goal of it is to use the threat of massive liability to whack energy companies. And again, these are hand-picked energy companies. We all contribute to climate change, like it or not. I mean, obviously some much more than others, but you could hand-pick an industry to target because someone's emitting carbon emissions, like agricultural sector, various other entities. So at the end of the day, you're really just trying to get the Congress or some policymaking body to act here. And as I mentioned, that the people bringing these lawsuits are candidly saying this. Like, this isn't just like, I mean, they openly admit it on a regular basis that, hey, we're doing this because we're fed up with Congress's inaction. In terms of a circumvention, I don't know, that's literally from the horse's mouth. I don't know what else you would want to validate that point. Just one more point on the climate change is, one of my favorite quotes by a judge on this issue in dismissing climate change cases in San Francisco and Oakland that were brought by those cities, is Judge Alsup, who's a Clinton appointee. If we didn't have fossil fuels, we would have lost World War II and every other war. Planes wouldn't fly, trains wouldn't run, and we'd be back in the Stone Age. And that just shows you the massive scale of this and how this is clearly a public policy, a national policy, a national energy policy issue. It's hard to say that's not really what's going on here.
Rich?
Sure. Yeah, so if a state attorney general goes to court and says, Your Honor, I'm here because I'm frustrated about the inability of my state or federal legislature to do something, the judge is going to say, that's nice to know. That's nice to know. Thank you very much. But where is your claim? Where is your damage? Where is your proof that somebody hurt your state? Otherwise, you're out of court. So whatever the main attorney general said or didn't say, it's not going to allow anyone to recover in public nuisance without meeting the fundamental elements of our tort system: damage and accountability, and proof of both. Without that, there is no case, no matter what the attorney general says about his or her motivation to bring a case. And as lawyers, we have to look at that. I mean, it makes nice newspaper stories to talk about what the attorney general's motivation is. But the case won't survive on that. It can't survive on that. It has to meet the elements of the claim. In terms of circumventing the legislature, once again, we need a legislature. We need a climate policy. We need an EPA. That, you know, the idea that you should have one but not have courts for people who are damaged. Policy is about what's happening today, how can we regulate this industry to protect people. and balance the competing interests that we have to look at. A lawsuit about damage is, my child is brain damaged because of the paint in this building that was promoted by this company as suitable for interior use when they knew it wasn't. Those are two different things. They're both important. They need to be separated, and we need both of them.
Can I respond to that?
Of course.
So Rich's point about what the elements of public nuisance law are, I think it explains why most of these cases have failed. And as I mentioned in my initial remarks, the attempt here is to turn public nuisance law into an essentially defenseless tort. That's what's going on here. And one of the examples of that is reframing public nuisance around the mere existence of an injury, as opposed to one is wrong, that is wrongfully caused by the conduct of the entity being sued, and dispensing with causation. We both agree that causation is an element, but what you have in some of these cases is an attempt to just basically turn that into nothing, to completely dispense with causation, because in some of like the lead paint cases, you're suing the entity that made the product, and maybe you're saying that their promotion of the product was really bad. Okay, well, again, as I mentioned, you can sue them for consumer protection violations for that, but if the product is being used in a way by a landlord, for example, they're the ones in control of the product, they're the ones who are failing to maintain a home, they're the ones who are wrongfully causing the injury. Yeah, if you think that the promotion of the product was unlawful, we have, again, product liability law, consumer protection law, you could throw in negligence and fraud even if you want it, if you think that that applies, but it's not public nuisance law. Public nuisance law is a completely different area of law, and if you're really trying to go after the person who was in control of the alleged thing that caused the harm, that would be in the case of lead paint, it would be a landlord, a private landlord, most likely, and in the other context, it would be like the person, for example, in the PFAS or PCB litigation, it would be the entity dumping that in the river. You don't sue the knife manufacturer when somebody gets stabbed. Just because in the knife manufacturer's selling a knife, knowing full well that somebody's gonna use that and stab somebody with it at some point. When that happens, you don't sue the knife manufacturer. And if that's too clumsy of an example, just think about the broader implications of allowing these public nuisance claims to proceed. I'll give you kind of what I would view as a more middle of the road from the knife example. You could take these public nuisance theories related to product externalities, and if you apply them to their logical conclusion, you could sue, say, a bubblegum company, because they sell a product knowing full well it's going to be discarded on a public sidewalk, and should you be allowed to sue Big Gum to abate every public sidewalk in America or every school desk where someone stuck gum underneath because they marketed their product knowing full well that that's how people were gonna discard it? I would argue no. And that's really what the logical conclusion is. Some of the, if you take these theories and adopted them, that's what happens. And what we're not discussing here is all the other implications of expanding, of opening that door. And which is why I think that you have the existing legal structure is perfectly suitable, it actually exists to address a lot of these problems.
All right, we got just about 15 more minutes, so I want to ask one more question, then we're going to open it up to the audience to any questions you may have. But one thing, and we talked a little bit about the history of public nuisance, and traditionally the remedy for public nuisance was an injunction or an abatement of the action, the putting a concrete barrier on the road, right? The remedy was to remove the barrier. It seems that in more recent uses of public nuisance, that's not going to be a feasible. Like you mentioned, we can't just cease all use of fossil fuels. What are maybe the consequences of that shift from an injunction to now a monetary damages relief? Richard, would you want to?
Sure. I mean, I think the abatement remedy of moving the concrete block out of the middle of the road is, in other words, how to deal with the problem. is perfectly analogous to the abatement remedy of we need money to remediate the lead paint conditions so more children in this city are not poisoned. You're, in both cases, it's a remedy. How do you fix the problem? You fix the block in the road by moving it. You fix the lead paint by abating the paint conditions in the dwellings. The governmental entity is spending money to do the latter. And that's why in public nuisance, the award is to address the problem. If the emergency rooms in this country are flooded with opioid patients and they have a lot more costs, and if it's a public hospital, they're saying, well why is this happening? You know, and we can't deal with all these patients. Why is this happening? If there is wrongdoing, over promotion of the product to explain some or all of that problem, then that entity, that governmental entity, shouldn't have to shift all of that to the taxpayer. They should be able to go to the person or the company that's responsible for the damage to recover the money to treat those patients instead of spreading it out over all the taxpayers in the community who are not at fault. There has to be a finding of fault. This general question of expansiveness of public nuisance and it's gonna go to bubble gum and look at all the bad cases that have lost kind of proves my point. If it's a bad case and it loses, the legal system has done its job. The victim or the alleged victim has gone to court, they've gotten their day in court, and they've lost. That's what happens in some cases. Some of these cases have brought important public health benefits to the communities. Some of them have lost. That's what happens in the legal system. That's not a reason to jettison a claim that has been part of our tort system for 500 years.
Thoughts?
Well, I mean, no one's arguing that we jettison public nuisance law. It's part of our legal system. It's the question is whether we expand public nuisance law to encompass any alleged annoyance, infringement on something that's of public interest. And that's really a major disconnect, and I would argue a major expansion of public nuisance law. And again, when you get into the marketing and promotion of products, we already have laws that exist specifically to address that. If you want to look at I agree, if you have a public nuisance and a court has found that a public nuisance exists, abatement costs are part of the remedy for that. Like that's perfectly legitimate. The question is really, does the public nuisance exist in the first place, as opposed to a violation of some other law, like in the opioid context? I mean, I would imagine there's enough bad actors there. There's probably fraud, negligence. I mean, some things that are not public nuisance law. Because again, public nuisance is an unreasonable interference with the public's land. And if you need some insights on the motivations of some of these lawsuits, so the California Supreme Court, as we've kind of alluded to this, or not California Supreme Court, California Trial Court, awarded $1.15 billion in a successful public nuisance case in the lead paint context there. That case, well, the California Supreme Court rejected review of that case, and which what I would argue is borders on judicial malpractice, because as Rich said, it's been an issue that has been percolating in the lower courts for 20 years. And for the court not to take it, for me, suggests that it probably wouldn't have found public nuisance liability. Regardless, that decision was stays because the court denied review. That case recently settled for $305 million. And if you want to know, this is probably the skeptic in me, but the reason why it settled, when you have a $1.1 billion verdict that gets settled for $300 million, it really was because that there's a California statute that doesn't allow the attorneys to collect if the funds were in an abatement fund. So the case was really, that to me shows me that the case was, if you're gonna sacrifice $800 million that you're supposed to give to lead poisoned children to abate their costs, and you're taking $800 million haircut just so you can pay the lawyers, what's really going on here?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. I'm not aware of those facts, and I'm not sure where they come from about the motivation of the lawyers. But those cases weren't brought, they were brought by 8 counties in California, and the decision about resolving that litigation is in the hands of the counties, not in the hands of the lawyers. And I just don't know, I'm not familiar with those facts, I've never seen them, they're not in any court record, and I'm just think that is really tragic speculation.
It's tragic talking to people who are in are deal with this, but again, I tried to give it that preface, and I probably should have, in fairness, I should have given it that is the speculation on my part. And the
second point I wanted to make is as our moderator read, the definition of public nuisance is not the invasion of land. Many of us have heard of a trespass. That's an invasion of land. The definition in our legal system is the invasion of a public right. So this distinction about land makes no sense when talking about public nuisance. That may have been the situation for the king in 1195 of England. It's not the situation in the United States of America in 2020.
All right. Well, on that note, I'd like to open it up for questions. We have about 10 minutes, and we'd like to get a couple. So please, if you have a question, I kind of work my way across the room. Gentleman in the back, might have to speak up. You are in the blue coat. Yeah.
This is for both of you with the big dumb example. So Mr. Appel said, hey, public nuisance is about interference with land. And you gave the example of gum sticking to the roads that cities really do have to clean up. I suppose it's $1 billion of the cost for the city. Why doesn't that fit kind of your definition of public nuisance? And for Mr. Lewis, with the big gum example, you said, well, if the court were to dismiss that, it would be doing its job because this case, it would be getting rid of the bad cases. What makes the big gum hypothetical a bad case?
Want to start, Chris?
Again, what we've been talking about, maybe I shouldn't have used the big gum example, but I actually think it's a pretty good example. But we're dealing with the externalities of the use of a product, which is the province of product liability, which is the area of law designed to govern the risks associated with the product. And you could also throw in, if there's a deceptive marketing of a product, you could throw in consumer protection statutes. These are deceptive practices statutes that are designed to address that behavior. Both of those address the uses of a product, the use and sale of a product. Public nuisance law doesn't address, I mean, because the individual is throwing the gum on the street. They're the ones who are in control of the gum. They're the ones who are putting it in the place that it shouldn't be. It's not the manufacturer of the gum that is doing that. So that's why public nuisance should fail. And that is just really what's going on in almost all of these cases is you have kind of a similar situation. You have somebody else disposing of a product that they shouldn't dispose of in that way. You have somebody else failing to clean up the lead paint on their home, a private landlord. You have someone dumping something in a river that they're not supposed to. But it's not the manufacturer doing this. And so that's why public nuisance law doesn't apply there.
Rich? Yeah, I mean, there are problems where there are more than one party at fault. If a landlord is on notice that there are hazardous lead paint conditions in his or her dwelling, our legal system, in fact, allows a claim against that landlord for the damages to the child. But for the city, who's looking at their housing stock in general, and they're asking themselves, how did this happen? Who's responsible for this? When there's evidence that the lead paint industry had the information in the 1950s and the 1940s and earlier, purposely covered it up, and then went and promoted the product specifically to be used in internal residence, in the internal, inside, indoor walls, windows and doors. That's how this problem occurs. Windows and doors are friction surfaces. They create dust when they get closed over and over again. That dust is what poisoned the kids. So those facts, that evidence, shows the accountability, shows the contribution of the lead paint manufacturer. They instructed the users to use it on the inside of dwellings. Okay? That's not really analogous to the bubble gum. Maybe if the bubble gum manufacturer said, chew the gum, enjoy the gum, and throw it on the sidewalk, it might be a little bit more similar. But
the difference would be if the manufacturer told the user to throw it on the sidewalk?
The difference, more broadly, is where is fault? Courts are in business to allocate fault, to make judgments about fault. What did you do? What did you not do? What did you know? What did you cover up? The answers to those questions will drive the decision by the judge or the jury. If they don't like the answers, they're going to rule against the plaintiff. So I can't give you a simple formula, but I think on one end you have the conduct of the lead paint industry. On the other end, I don't think you can really analogize that to bubble gum sales, because the person who bought the paint was told to use it on the interior walls. The person who bought the gum probably knows if they drop the gum on the sidewalk, it's going to be a problem for somebody walking down the sidewalk.
All right. Other questions? Gentleman right here in the middle.
What would be the federal role here? I mean, a lot of these are, is there federal private nuisance or public nuisance law, or is there anything for the federal government?
So the claims of public nuisance, it's a state law theory, negligence, product liability, all these damages theories in our legal system are questions of state law. Okay, so these cases, the ones that are going forward, are, for example, in climate change, some of the cases have been thrown out in federal court. More cases have been sent back to the state court judge and said, please proceed, by the federal court judge, saying this is a matter of state law. So, you know, in climate change, there isn't a forum for a federal public nuisance claim based on existing law. But under each, the Supreme Court did not address, well, what about state public nuisance law? That will come up in some of these cases that are now going forward. So when you say, what is the role of the federal system, I guess I would distinguish between, well, there's a federal legislative role, but the federal courts are not applying federal law to these damage claims. These are based on state law, whether it's applied by a state judge or a federal judge who happens to have jurisdiction over the case.
Other questions? You're right here.
Do any of you have thoughts on what might be next? What, where we might, what new areas where we might see public nuisance law apply?
I mean, actually, you're the on the plaintiff's side. You probably know better. You probably know the answer.
I can't disclose my work.
But I mean, if I were speculating, again, I'm far speculating too much on one part. What you're going to see, I think, in the future is a rise of these locality lawsuits, I think. I think that's going to be the next evolution of public nuisance law, just because it's a lot easier for someone to convince, like a plaintiff's lawyer to convince a local government official to bring a case than it is probably a state attorney general, just as a practical matter. There's a lot more of local government officials, and it's easier to get access to a lot of them. And so you're going to have attempted partnerships with them and you've already seen a lot of that litigation play out in the opioid context, and you've seen some of the climate change cases, about a dozen or so, have been filed by local governments. In terms of what is, other than big gum, other than the next attempted, what I would argue is a policy-making endeavor to get some spur some action at the federal level, I would leave that for Rich to speculate.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I don't accept the connection between bringing public nuisance lawsuits and trying to advance in a legislative agenda. Those are different problems, and they're different parts of our governmental system that have different functions to deal with them. I mean, I'm trained in public health, so what is the definition? I think the people trained in public health have their eye on invasions of public rights, because public health is such a right. And, you know, when you have a chemical that is getting into the drinking water all over the country and pregnant women and children are drinking that water, you got a problem. So the next one that comes up like that, it'll be a public nuisance suit along with these other claims. So widespread public health threats are going to be amenable to these types of approaches.
I think we got time for one more, so we'll swing over here, sir. I saw you in the back first. There.
All right. I had a question about, you mentioned a lot that the standard of causation is a necessary element to prove any public nuisance liability. And I was first operating under the assumption that that standard is relatively consistent throughout different state courts. Would that be the premise that we can agree on at least? Yes.
I would agree that the words in the cases are pretty consistent.
Okay.
You know, different judges are human beings, and,
right.
and they're not always perfectly consistent.
So, in a situation like this, wherein you can have a very similar set of facts interpreted completely opposite ways, but specifically I'm referring to the opioid litigation, there have actually been three specific rulings on public nuisance claims against Purdue Pharma. So presumably their operations within each state were not radically different from one another. And yet two of those three judges ruled that there was no direct causation proved, and the one in Oklahoma most recently proved that all of a sudden there was. So if there's the possibility to have this different interpretation of what does and does not constitute this direct causation, isn't there the same concern that there's, if there's a wiggle room there, that it would be kind of an end around of having to prove it, you just have to find the right judge?
Very quickly.
Yeah, I mean the concern about consistency across judges runs throughout all areas of the law, and it's, they're human beings, and it's a real concern. It's not a more or less of a concern in this area. But we have a long history in our legal system of cases winning and losing. I mean, it's messy. It's not perfect. It's not clean. Somebody said that about legislation once also. And I just accept it. I wish it wasn't so. I wish we had more consistency, but you know, you have many different factors. You have different facts in each case. You have nuances of state law, different judges, skills of different lawyers. Sometimes you have jurors, and they're certainly not all the same. So it's sort of a built-in reality of not a perfect system, but one that most of us think is better than the alternative, which is, you know, Chief Mr. X making all the decisions for what's good for society.
All right, very quickly.
I think adding one little point to that is that the Oklahoma case, that involved a specific state statute that defined public nuisance law very broadly. So the court, at least in that case, was operating under a statutory provision as opposed to the common law. And what we've been discussing all day is the common law. So it is, for all the reasons Rich mentioned about different courts and all that, you have that added layer of actually one statutory law and one's common law. So.
All right. On that note, please join me in thanking Rich and Chris for joining us today.